Welcome to Beyond90Seconds.com. I'm Mark Horner. As I sit at my desk at home this evening, recording these words, I do so thinking about a murder that began to unfold exactly 10 years ago tonight. For it was right around this time, on the evening of September 9th, 1999, that a woman named Girlie Chu Hasenkopf was kidnapped from her Albuquerque apartment. Her final breaths unfolding, along with the unspeakable acts that investigators believe led up to her death, and, in an even more grotesque fashion, the acts they say immediately followed Girlie's death. You see, Girlie Chu Hasenkopf's body, her remains really, still have not been found. But the evidence, the bloodstained tarp, the ninja sword, the saliva mixed with her blood, well, the prosecution, the police, they say it speaks volumes. The man Girlie was divorcing, the diabolical, severely impish Daisen Hasenkopf, is doing life in prison. So is his girlfriend, Linda Henning, a believer in the teachings of David Icke, to include the belief that many of our world's leaders are, in their view, shape-shifting, bloodthirsty reptilians who prefer nothing more than the drink of starfire found within the blood of a freshly killed menstruating woman. A third person in this case, the guy investigators claimed was the muscle behind the murder, was never convicted of anything resembling the gravity of all of that. Instead, Bill Miller pleaded guilty to a few misdemeanors related to the tampering of evidence. He got credit for time served, about 7 weeks in jail. In fact, Miller's filed suit against three of the investigators, essentially claiming he was the victim of their malicious prosecution. The suit struck out in one court, but the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals recently kicked it back for another go-round in a lower court due to what you might say amounts to a technicality. The lower court's addressing the allegations from Miller separately rather than collectively as a single claim. But back to Girlie, for it is all too often that we forget the victim in cases of murder and other severely brutal crimes, but not tonight, not now. And I assure you, the significance of this night is not lost on many people, to include the lead prosecutor in the case, Paul Spears. Earlier today, I spoke with Spears by telephone. Shortly after the 2002 Linda Henning trial, Spears left the DA's office in New Mexico and went to work for the United States Attorney's Office in Albuquerque. That is where he continues to work to this day as an assistant U.S. attorney. I now share our recorded, unedited conversation. I won't even begin to further lay out the extremely widespread facts of the case, but feel free to Google Hasenkopf, Hasenkopft. Or you might even choose to visit the website I started back in October of 1999, dedicated to this case. You can find that website at markhorner.com/Has. That's Hoss. If you want even more information, you can feel free to look up my book about the case, September Sacrifice. You can find it on Amazon. It's also available at many local libraries. One disclaimer before we hear from Mr. Spears, the views he expresses during our conversation are not necessarily the views of the Department of Justice or the United States Attorney's Office. He was speaking to me not as an assistant U.S. attorney, rather, he spoke to me in a personal capacity. Now, with that said, I'll share that our discussion began with my mention of this, the 10th anniversary of Girlie's disappearance. Does Paul Spears find this benchmark date especially meaningful? All of a sudden, it's a decade or 10 years. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself absent of my phone call to you, reminding you of it? Did you find yourself thinking of it any more profoundly than in years past this time around, given that it's kind of a benchmark time now, 10 years?
Well, I can't say any more profoundly. And the thinking of it is less frequent. Usually the thinking of it is stimulated by seeing people that I know and came to know and worked with on the case yourself. And I see Mike Fox every once in a while. We have a cup of coffee. I saw him recently, and we chatted a little bit about it. small things will every once in a while excite a memory of the case. More often than not, it goes more into the memories of how special it was to be working on something that was so engaging, exciting, and important. And each moment that we worked on it, we built upon the work we had previously done, and then we would discover new surprises and new complexities and new discoveries along the way, which were never dull. It was quite an exciting period of time.
And so people aren't confused. When you say exciting, you also did mention important. There was this rush of having to close in on the killer or killers as quickly as possible and follow the trails of evidence that were accumulating, knowing full well that the suspect or suspects could very well be doing their best to be as evasive as possible, possibly even leaving the area. So there's that type of excitement, but at the same time, as with any murder case, the profound realization of a loss of life.
Right. At first, there was no way to appreciate the magnitude of the case and the evil of the case. At first, we related to the case in a way wherein we thought we were trying to discover the whereabouts of somebody who very well may have voluntarily left, but was still quite alive. And that gave way to the growing thoughts that something nefarious had happened, and that people had done harm to Gurley and had secreted her in some locale where she was still alive, but where she had been kidnapped to. And then our efforts were accelerated towards using whatever instruments and tools in the toolbox were available to us to discover where she was, knowing that the time window for finding her alive may have really been shrinking quite quickly. And then, of course, as time passed through that phase, we came more and more to the conclusion that she had been murdered.
A lot of questions come to mind. How profound is it to you that her remains have not been found?
I think that's the most moving aspect of the case, moving in the sense of feeling an abiding and deep remorse and regret that all of our considerable efforts that we dedicated to the case have been and were unsuccessful in recovering her. Not for the cases, not for whatever assistance or aid it may have lent to the case, but more in terms of restoring a diminished completeness to and for her family. And as people more evocatively have captured it than I am and have, but have brought a peace to a wandering sense of sadness about her being lost in some wilderness and so terribly inconsolably alone, that there would be some way of bringing her back to a community and family that loved her. And in the end, she would not be all alone. It was largely what motivated us. But now that the case has been completed in terms of the law, the morality of and the sensibility of sanctuary for her spirit and soul overwhelms the prosaic nature of what we do as humans on the landscape that we're on. It goes to something else. It goes to something much more sacred and meaningful that is impossible to capture appropriately in words and language.
Do you ever hear from her family?
No, I have not. I have not. I don't think that's altogether a bad thing. The prevailing sense I have about that is that her family, particularly Andrew, have found ways to go on with their lives and to be happy with their lives without the awful reminder of what happened to their sister and daughter.
It's been several months, if not a year or so, since I last corresponded with Gurley's brother, Andrew Chu. We should point out that the family lives in Malaysia. At that time, he'd not only married June, so he has a wife, they have a child. I believe at the time I spoke with him or emailed with him, I'd learned also that, sadly, his father, Gurley's father, has since passed away. Had you heard that?
No, I hadn't.
That only seemed at the moment I learned that to kind of accentuate that sadness that you spoke about a moment ago in terms of not finding the remains.
Well, it is sad. And I keep hoping that, I keep hoping and actually believing that in some way or another, we will ultimately find her. That's my hope and my belief.
There's a school of thought that people have a hard time keeping their mouth shut in situations, especially like this one, where a murder has taken place, that ultimately, in time, someone talks. Do you think it's likely that people, in addition to Hasenkopf, Linda Henning and Diazin Hasenkopf, that people, in addition to those two, have direct knowledge indirect knowledge of Gurley's fate to include the whereabouts of her remains?
I subscribe to that theory that you've just described. And I think it's more complicated in this case and handicapped. It may very well be that at one time Hasenkopf and Henning knew where Gurley was because they were present for her initial so-called resting place. But I think that knowledge of theirs may have been since eradicated, and that they may not know. They may not know in actual fact where Gurley's remains are or were. That would be because another party took it upon him or herself to recognizing the danger to where she was because of the developing investigation and news stories, took it upon themselves to unilaterally move those remains and either destroy them or put them in a place that became exceedingly difficult to find because of whatever expertise that person may have had in the outdoors or survival-style situations.
It's not an uncommon behavioral pattern,
that
is
would
it?
Mean that only, in the end, that would mean that only one person would have known, would know where she is.
You think it's likely that that one person may have told somebody something?
Well, that gets to the issue of human boastfulness and wanting to take pride in your endeavors and being unable to resist the temptation to trumpet yourself and your actions. I think it's a close call. I don't know. In the end, I suppose somebody would want to share that confidence. But it's hard to say. It's difficult to say. I think it's as we well know now, it's not yet resolved, that particular issue.
For people familiar with the case, it's no secret that the investigation took a long, hard look at Bill Miller. And even at one point, it got an initial grand jury to indict him on conspiracy to commit murder, as I recall, kidnapping, and other charges. Ultimately, it went back to a second grand jury, and in large part, the state's case crumbled to the point where he pleaded to, I think it was 3 misdemeanor crimes, to include tampering with evidence. When you talk about someone perhaps going back alone and going back to where the body had been left and then relocating it, are you still thinking Bill Miller all these years later?
There was a considerable body of circumstantial evidence that established a factual predicate for somebody developing that conclusion that he was involved. So that's not a radical proposition.
The case remains sensitive all these years later in terms of talking about someone like Miller.
Could you, was that a question?
Yeah, I mean, do you feel like you have to be very guarded in your language when speaking about Bill Miller because he was never convicted of any felonies in this matter? Or do you feel comfortable?
Not particularly. One can accurately and faithfully describe what the evidence was. That's not a problem to do that. As I said before, I think that there was considerable muscle, evidentiary muscle, to substantiate the case, and it was substantiated. The grand jury did return, as you referenced, an indictment against him that included conspiracy to commit the first-degree murder and kidnapping charges and a whole host of other related offenses. It was in the end that the case, in the very end, the case devolved with regard to him. But there were a universe of attendant factors to that, not necessarily all of them fact related to the case, but there was a lot going on with his case at that point in time, at the end of it.
In June of 2000, roughly 9 months after Gurley's disappearance, a very large search unfolded west of Magdalena, about 120 miles southwest of Albuquerque. And it was a two-day search, and on that second day, a number of the searchers were sent home because some of the cadaver dogs had alerted on one specific mine shaft, one of many, countless mine shafts in that area. And so you focused your attention, brought in the experts to shore up that mine that went straight down into the ground and remove all of the folded bits of metal, large sheets, I should say. It looked like an old tin roof. And ultimately, you get to the bottom, and you found some partial remains of an elk, if I recall correctly, but no human remains. Now, those dogs are trained to alert on human remains, and they're tested to do so and make sure that they don't falsely alert when they find animal remains. When you spoke earlier about someone going back to the mine shaft, or not to the mine shaft, you said to a location where the body may have been initially disposed of. Do you to this day believe that Gurley's remains were in that mine shaft at one point?
I do.
And it's not uncommon, is it, for people who are associated with a murder, oftentimes the killer himself or herself, once disposing of a body, to want to go back to it and move it again?
Well, that I don't know. I think that would be in large part dictated by concern that the hiding place was becoming vulnerable or vulnerable to discovery. I understand that people like to find some souvenir-style glory in their deeds by revisiting. I think it would have been less that, if indeed that happened, less that than some person or persons feeling increasingly anxious about the hiding place being compromised and discovered, which would then necessitate a compelling reason to move the remains to a more a less traveled place where the remains would be exceedingly more difficult to discover.
One of the more amazing moments in this case was actually September 10th, 1999, a day that Gurley did not report to work, but lo and behold, on that same morning, her blouse and some duct tape and her hair, her undergarment, they were all found alongside of the road, that Highway 60, I believe it was, west of Magdalena, by a state highway worker, and the tarp, a bloodstained tarp. When you speak of someone going back to move a body, if they suspect that the investigation might be tipped off to the general whereabouts, do you think news accounts of that discovery by the state highway worker, Mr. Gabaldon, might be just the catalyst for someone to provoke someone to go back and move a body?
Yes, I do. I don't know what the sequence of events was. I don't recall anymore what the sequence of events were at that time, or the sequence was. That certainly, if reported, would have been something that would have alarmed somebody who was involved about that, because for one, those artifacts were so closely found to what we believe was the initial hiding place for Gurley's remains. It wasn't far away at all. But as I remember it, and my memory could be flawed now with the passage of time, my memory was that there were stories that broke in the local news, I think both in the print and video news on the local TV stations and also in the Albuquerque Journal, that next week, which would have been, a Friday was the 10th, Monday the 13th, Tuesday the 14th. I think there was a burgeoning news coverage of these issues of Gurley missing, and perhaps also included in the stories were the notation of the the tarpaulin and the bloodied artifacts being found there in Magdalena.
Yeah, is
so
there...
that is a all those things would have definitely triggered an alarm in somebody and an anxiety that would have provided a persuasive reason to perhaps correct a flawed hiding place for the remains, an initially flawed hiding place for the remains.
As I recall, it was Channel 7, KOAT TV, who actually broke the story of Gurley's disappearance. I believe it was reporter Jeff Zevely. And without diving back into my book or the materials, the research I did, I don't recall whether or not that initial report mentioned the discovery of Gurley's clothing and other evidence along the side of the highway near Magdalena. But yeah, to give credit where it's due, I believe it was Channel 7 that broke that story. Where does this case rank in the landscape of mileposts of your professional career as a prosecutor? We should point out that it wasn't long after you succeeded with your team at the DA's office of getting a conviction on the murder and kidnapping charges against Linda Henning that you moved on to the U.S. Attorney's Office, no longer now working for the state. Ever since that time, shortly after the Henning trial, you've been working for the federal government as an assistant U.S. attorney, correct?
Right.
So where does this case stand out? I mean, you've worked at the state level, the federal level. I'm sure you've seen all sorts of interesting cases. You have the Navy background. You were a JAG prior to your time with the state years earlier. Where does this rank?
Well, by definition, it was and has been one of the most challenging cases that I've had occasion to work on. It required and demanded a very high level of performance from everybody involved in the case, everybody. And the case could not have been done had not each team player been discharging that high level of performance on a daily basis for years. But there's no question about it. It was and has been one of the most unique cases that I've had occasion to work on, most challenging cases. And there have been other challenging cases, but none that required such a sustained energy level, not only the physical energy that is required to get up every day and get up every morning and do the work, but also the thinking part of it. Other cases have engaged those sorts of requirements, but over a much shorter and less sustained period of time. The other thing about the case that was unique is, sadly, the players in this case, Hossenkopf and Henning, as evil as they were, and as dedicated to evil as they were both very, very bright. And that, in the on the criminal landscape, that's an unusual facet to the work. Not often are you dealing with defendants who are as bright and in their own perverse ways dedicated to crime doing as they were. And they had applied considerable thought and planning to their endeavors, and it also in covering their tracks. So it was unique. It was quite unique, and not because I don't like the work, which I do, but I hope never to have another case like it. Because if I don't, that means then somebody didn't make such an awful fate as Gurley did, which must have been indeed truly, truly horrible.
In the courtroom, you painted out a scenario that some on the defense side took a special exception to. And I'm talking about this whole scenario that the state contends likely played out, wherein Gurley was basically cut up with the ninja sword and made to suffer a horrific death, and that the participants in that death, that killing, actually ate of her flesh. To this day, does that seem to be the likely scenario that unfolded in your mind?
I think it's part of it. I think it all probably happened in some sort of ceremonial way. They were fascinated by this that culture of just strange tribal notions, and it was fairly well documented in the investigation of the case. So I think it's unlikely that they didn't do that, and we took pains not to sensationalize the case, because in sensationalizing the case, it threatened to diminish the gravity of what we were trying to accomplish. But on the other hand, if it was a part of the case, then to not make reference to it and not incorporate it into the case would have been to unnaturally diminish the reality of the case. It would have artificialized the case, and there's no sense in that either. So I think it actually captured what would in all probability occurred.
When you talked about a moment ago the sustained effort of the investigators and the intense workload, just for clarification purposes, because not everybody may be aware of exactly how this unfolded, but this case itself, let's see here, before it first goes to finally reaches a trial, which would have been the Henning case, which, as I recall, was October of 2002, correct?
That's right. I think it started October 1st of 2002.
And so that took 3 years just to get to that point. And speaking of the first year as it unfolded, going from literally September 10th, the morning of 1999, when Gurley didn't show up for work in the morning, for the next at least 9 months, because that's when we know you're in the desert down in Magdalena, not the first time, by the way, but this is your high-profile search with plane in the sky, people on horseback, all sorts of people on foot. That alone is 9 months. And for 9 months, there was this accelerated pace where oftentimes you folks were working on Sundays, working well into your evenings, spending profound amounts of time, away from your families. Basically, and it wasn't just because you love the case, there was this sense of urgency that I seem to detect from all of you. When I say you, I mean the investigators at the DA's office, the police detectives, and everybody who's supporting this effort, right down to the crime lab. There just seems to be this, you got to get it done now to get to the next step before someone can possibly spring forth beyond your grasp. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. That is entirely accurate. Completely accurate.
Even though Gurley's body has not been found, or what's left of her body, the remains, are you at peace with the case, knowing that you got the convictions that you did?
I'm at peace with it.
You still feel as if Hasenkopf burned?
Peace with it is in part compromised by feeling a sensation that it's incomplete still, and may forever be incomplete. Incomplete insofar as not finding Gurley, which I've said before, in many ways overwhelmed in importance the actual mechanics of prosecuting the case, and the not inconsiderable value in that. There's a sense of failure in not having found her body. We tried hard. And we tried hard for a long time, and in many ways that was our compass and our navigational reference point all the way through it, that guided us and propelled us forward. And then to have done all of what we did and not find her, it's very, very, very disheartening. And there's a sense of not being at peace with the result for those reasons. There are aspects of the case that I do not feel at peace with because there are aspects of the case that I will never know. I will never know what really happened. I will never know what acts were really performed on her. What things were said to her just before she was dispatched to another world. Those things I will never know, and none of us will, unless somebody wants to talk and somebody starts to talk, which it becomes, I think, increasingly unlikely now. So so I'm not at peace. I'm not entirely at peace with it. But the lack of being at peace with the case comes more from not as much from the actual procedural aspects of prosecuting a case and doing the things that you do or are meant to do as a prosecutor. They come more from in terms of the humanity of the case and the recognition of the incompleteness of the law, which in the end which never really gets right at restoring the damage that is done to humans when other humans decide they want to perform acts of evil on another innocent and vulnerable people that they've come to know or not know. So, to answer your question, no, I'm not at complete peace with the case.
When I think about what you just expressed, I found myself reminded of FBI agent John Shum, because Gurley had actually gone to him prior to her disappearance to say that Dyson was threatening was letting her know that she would be killed and no one would ever find her body. And in a sense, his hands were arguably tied because, to his knowledge, there had been no violation of the restraining order. And as I recall, he later said something to the effect of it was the first time he had met the victim of such a case, because ultimately we know that she dies. If one were to be haunted, I mean, in your situation, no, the body was not found. But what a feeling it must be to have the living body before you one moment and then to have that person gone.
Yeah, I can't answer that question because I haven't had that experience, but you're right. It must be
a lot of people were touched by this case in a myriad of ways, and that's one that's not lost on me as well. When I think of Hasenkopf, let me ask you, to your knowledge, is Hasenkopf still at a federal facility in Rawlins, Wyoming?
I don't think, I may be mistaken, but I thought he was at a state facility in Wyoming.
That's right, it was a state facility. To your knowledge, is he still at a state facility in Rawlins, Wyoming?
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what I have no other information to. I have no other information contrary to that.
I rather sense, and I know you can't speak for the man, but I rather sense that this gives this guy some satisfaction, whether or not he really knows where the body is. Satisfaction that people have not found it, that Paul Spears has not found it, that Mike Fox has not found it. I would imagine that this is something, and knowing that he has kept that closure, if you will, from occurring for members of Gurley's own family, this is a guy who seems to get profound satisfaction in the way the cards are laid out right now.
Yes and no. Yes, if indeed he knows where, he knows in actual fact where the remains of Gurley are. No, if he's been eclipsed by somebody else in terms of that, then he'll in his own sick way, he's going to be forever haunted. And there's a delicious irony in that, at least in that sick context, that if another person, changed the resting place, the final resting place of Gurley, then Hasenkopf himself and Henning herself will never know. And so he holds that over nobody. And he himself was what's the word for it? Outsmarted in the end.
Paul, if someone knows,
I guess it just depends on if you subscribe to the view that, and the idea that her remains were moved from that mine shaft, and that she was initially in the mine shaft and then moved, then Hasenkopf and Henning don't get that pleasure of thinking that they, in that respect, outwitted everybody and have steadfastly honored the secret.
If someone knows information concerning the whereabouts of the remains, or any other information distinctly relevant to that part of the investigation, and they want to come forward, what would be a way that they could do that?
Oh, they could do it. The ways are virtually unlimited. I think they could let one of the reporters who covered the case know anonymously, or not. They could let you know. You have a beautiful website that you've manicured over the years, that it's exhaustively and comprehensively covered the case, and you at times have been a great focal point for people discussing the case and also providing information. So you and your website, the reporters who covered the case, Jolene Gutierrez Kruger, any of the TV outlets here, or of course, I mean, the classic way would be to let Detective Mike Fox or somebody from the Albuquerque Police Department know. Anybody can do it anonymously or otherwise. But a letter, a phone call, anything.
As I recall, it's been 4 years, 4.5 years, hard to believe, basically, since I've worked at a TV station in Albuquerque, but as I recall, the anonymous tip line locally was 88 crime. Does that ring a bell?
it has a ringtone to it.
Yeah. Oh, my. It's funny. I think about how things might have been a bit different in terms of the dissemination of information. With today's technology, had it existed 10 years ago, everything would have been Twittered, it seems, and who knows what.
And then somebody would have to educate me as to how to make sense out of all that.
Yeah, tweeted, I should have said. Anyway, well, very good. I thank you very much for your time. I know of two cases in New Mexico where convictions were produced in nobody cases. This is one. The other one I'm aware of is the Marie Parker case, which was closely associated with the David Parker Ray case, but it was Roy Yancey who ultimately was convicted in that case. Her body had never been found. And it takes a heck of a lot of work and teamwork in particular, and I guess investment of resources and ultimately money to yield a conviction or convictions in cases like this one. I remember very well something, and I guess I'll wrap up with this. Interviewing you after you got the guilty convictions on Henning, you emerged from the courtroom, and I was reporting live for a TV station in Albuquerque. And I believe it was at that time that you told me that I had raised, you know, you went in there with basically circumstantial evidence, and you said something to the effect of circumstantial evidence can be a beautiful thing.
Can be, and in our case, it ended up being a beautiful thing. It put some really bad people away.
And so that it's not lost on people just to dismiss it as perhaps evidence light. a lot of that circumstantial evidence was a heck of a lot of work that was done in the forensic lab.
Yes.
Tremendous amount of forensic work was done on this case, and I don't know that there's ever been a case in New Mexico prior or since that time that has involved the degree of forensic work that went into this case, and the unimaginables went under the microscope in this one.
Well, it did, and one of the, you know, it can be superficial to say circumstantial evidence is a beautiful thing, but it is. But one of the reasons why it is because it engages, by necessity, engages a jury to do more than a jury ordinarily may do with direct evidence. It means that a jury also has to play rightfully its role and use their collective brains to more aggressively engage the case and test the quality of the case. It's easier to do if the evidence is spoon-fed to you directly. Circumstantial evidence means that facts are established, and from those facts, inferences are made from established facts. That's a dynamic that is really requires of a jury a vitality that is a little unique. And we had a very, very bright jury. We had a lot of engineers in the jury. And they used their wits and their minds to... Probably what they did is what they used their minds to do is, after we had presented the case, they tore it apart and rebuilt it. And in the end, it conformed to the instructions given by the court. But that's a challenging thing to do, and that jury did it. And so it's beautiful in that sense, where it engages a vitality with a jury that is a little bit unique. The other thing that you've touched upon that is couldn't go again without being spoken about is the enormous support given to us by the Albuquerque Police Department and also particularly by then District Attorney Jeff Romero and his first assistant, Pete Dinelli. They unhesitatingly, on every instance, supported the case by resources and otherwise, where if that support hadn't been as unhesitating and unflinching as it was, the case would have lost confidence, but it also would have lost the ability to construct an infrastructure that would have supported the weight of the case. And they did that. They deserve considerable praise for it.
Fantastic.
Well, Paul, one final thought occurred to me as I thought about the prospect of us chatting about the case after 10 years is the phenomenon that I've observed anyway, which is that parallel the parallel and the relationship between nature and cases. I've noted that oftentimes in big events, as my father once pointed out to me, before big things happen in the world and in human events, they're often presaged by and foreshadowed by nature. A snowstorm, a storm, or rain. And on the night of this case, the night back on September 9th, 1999, I believe there was a slight drizzle that night. And when we began the presentation of the case on October 1st of 2002, outside the window of the courtroom, it was a dark morning, and I believe it was similarly, there was a mist outside, and there was a similar light rain falling. So that was an interesting, for me anyway, that was an interesting observation, which paralleled what sometimes happens in our lives. for instance, the Kennedy inauguration was presaged by a violent snowstorm in Washington, a blizzard. And it's fine. In thinking about our prospective chat for this morning, I thought about that last night. How it's just an interesting thought. That's all.
An interesting thought, and it also had certainly relevance in terms of September 9th as it turned into September 10th back in 1999, because there was the contention that this is why Henning would want, in particular, to have had her car cleaned shortly after that date, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
If it were to have gone off.
Also, there's another case, the case of Jeffrey McDonald. Joe McGinnis wrote a book titled Fatal Vision. And I believe in that case, the same thing. There was a rain falling, or a gentle rain falling that night, the night of those heinous murders in North Carolina. I think it was Fort Bragg.
Yeah.
Anyway, just an observation for what it's worth.
Well, it's a nice kind of you to share it with us from the. I mean, that's something that one might normally keep to himself, especially because of the personal nature. Something that your dad had remarked, and it's interesting that in the grand, as you step back and look at 10 years having passed, and you ponder this and. That the thoughts of your father come to mind in that regard. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
My pleasure, Mark. Any time that you'd like to pick up the phone or chat about the case, I'd be delighted to do it. I was fortunate that our paths crossed. During this case, and I'm fortunate in that path crossing, I made a friend, and I count myself lucky and blessed to have come to know you.
Likewise, great respect for the work that you do and for the way that you conduct your life. Thank you very much for your time today, Paul.
Oh, you're perfectly welcome, Mark, anytime.
Once again, a special thank you to Paul Spears, our guest on Beyond90Seconds.com, 10 years after the kidnapping and murder of Gurley Chu Hasenkopf, whose remains have yet to be found. Thank you for listening. I'm Mark Horner.